Welcome to a special episode of Trial Lawyer View, where we are going to delve into a remarkable verdict that has made headlines across Illinois. Today, I have the privilege of speaking with Mike Bonamardi, managing partner at Levin and Perconte, who recently obtained a groundbreaking verdict in a medical malpractice lawsuit. The case was tried by Mike and several members of his firm, along with a partner at Spiros Law. After they tried the case, a Coles County jury took less than 3 hours to deliver the largest medical malpractice verdict in Illinois history outside of Cook County, a staggering $40 million verdict for a 19-year-old disabled teen, Kiara Campbell, and her parents for birth-related permanent brain injuries. During this episode, we'll explore the details of this extraordinary case. I'm going to ask Mike to walk us through the journey that led to this momentous verdict. Thank you for joining this episode of Trial Lawyer View as we delve into the legal strategies, challenges, and the pursuit of justice that brought about this landmark verdict. Mike, welcome to Trial Lawyer View. Appreciate you taking the time to be here with me today.
Thanks for having me, Jason. Happy to be here.
Can you walk us through the key aspects of the case, including the specifics of the medical malpractice claims and how they contributed to the birth injuries suffered by Kiara Campbell?
I'll start perhaps a little bit more broad. The case involved Jamie and Todd, who this was their second child, Kiara. And one of the nuances in the case and a bit of a challenge was that Kiara was born in May of 2003. And that in and of itself was something that we explored in jury selection. And more specifically, we asked sort of some just general questions about how the fact that the case was about 20 years old at the time we brought it to the jury, how that could influence people. And for the most part, there wasn't too much trouble with that concept. There were a couple of people that we were fearful may hold it against us, and maybe that it meant something was wrong with the case, that it took so long to get it to trial. The truth of it was that, I'll say maybe perhaps a little bit more of the defendant, they took a lot of depositions, and it prolonged, in my opinion, the discovery process leading up to trial. But just back, simply stated, the facts were as such. On May 20th of 2003, in the middle of the night, around 1:30 in the morning, Jamie, who was 5 days past her due date, woke up, and she felt a gush. And her husband turned the light on and saw a pretty significant amount of blood on the sheets. They didn't panic. They called 911. 911 brought Jamie and Todd to Sarah Bush Lincoln Hospital, and they arrived at about 1:55 in the morning. And going to the end of the story, Kiara was born at 3:17 in the morning. And the theory in the case, the theme in the case, was that at the time Jamie presented to the hospital with her unborn baby, there was enough information for the team to know that they needed to get assembled and be in a position to intervene should the pregnancy not proceed with the appropriate speed and should any changes in the fetal heart rate strips materialize on those fetal heart tracings. There was an initial call at about 2:05 in the morning between a nurse who was a defendant, Nurse Allison Massey, and a doctor who was at home asleep but on call, Dr. Michael Benson. And our theory in the case was that at that time, Jamie had woken up in a pool of blood. She was remote from delivery, only about 2 to 3 centimeters dilated and about 50% of face. And she had abdominal pain. And these were all signs and symptoms of a medical event called a placental abruption. And at that time of the phone call, what was admitted during discovery was that Nurse Massey was thinking that that's likely what was going on. Dr. Benson at his deposition testified that based on whatever information was communicated, he felt it was more likely a bloody show, which some expectant mothers, that's how they present. It could be a benign cause, but if it is a placental abruption, what it means is that the placenta is separating from the wall of the uterus, and the placenta serves sort of as the unborn baby's lungs. It delivers oxygen and blood to the placenta. And if it progresses and you're remote from delivery, it could impact the baby's oxygenation levels. And that's sort of what was borne out after the fact. So what happened from there is the doctor goes back to bed, and at about 2:30 in the morning, the fetal heart rate strips start to show some signs of deterioration. There's multiple decelerations. They become more frequent. They become prolonged. And by the time Dr. Benson gets to the hospital, as well as the rest of the team, at about 2:45 to 2:50 in the morning, they do what's necessary to deliver the baby, but the baby's not delivered until 3:17 in the morning, and suffers a permanent anoxic brain injury. The baby had some mild cerebral palsy, and it's not something that necessarily goes away, but because it was a mild form of cerebral palsy, with appropriate therapy that she underwent as a child, and she has to continue to stay active to this day, she's largely physically normal. She actually testified in the case. She, over our objection, which I can get into, but she graduated from high school with accommodations, and she can drive. She's limited to certain areas in Coles County, which is a small county in the middle part of the state, toward southern part of the state. And, you know, what sort of remarkable, in my opinion, about the verdict is, number one, you know, it shows that just because somebody looks normal, just because somebody doesn't have the horrible version of cerebral palsy, you can still get a big verdict if you can show how the injury that happened at birth as a result of the neglect in the case has impacted her throughout her life and will continue to impact her. And the second thing that I think is really important is, you know, as a trial lawyer representing plaintiffs, we hear a lot from judges, from mediators, well, you're not in Cook County. And that's the statement is made to suggest that you can't get fair value or the types of verdicts that you do in Cook County. And this, I think, completely busts that myth. So those are sort of the broad strokes about the type of case that we tried, and obviously were successful.
Well, as I said when I introduced it, the jury returned a landmark verdict of $40 million, which was the largest medical malpractice verdict in Illinois outside of Cook County. What trial strategies or factors do you believe influenced the jury's decision to award such a substantial amount? Because I know it was more than you asked for, and almost 15 times more than they had ever offered to settle the case.
As is the case with any trial, the preparation that went into it. I mean, we did a full-fledged focus group in January or February before the trial. And initially, the focus of the case was about timing. You know, it took, for example, 2:05, we say the doctor should have come to the hospital, and there's a 25-minute delay before the doctor's called again. And that's kind of the case that we focus grouped. And then, you know, at 2:48, the doctor gets to the hospital. We were focusing on the time that it got the rest of the people it took to get the rest of the people on the team. Because it's important to note, this is a smaller, small town hospital. So they don't have, for example, you know, the pediatrician or neonatologist is not in the hospital. The anesthesiologist is not in the hospital. The assistant to the surgery is not in the hospital. So, I mean, we sort of kind of took that, wasn't necessarily one of the major defenses in the case, but it was raised throughout the course of the trial. And we sort of turn that against him in that, well, if that's the case, then when you have the presentation that you had at 2:00 in the morning, 2:05 in the morning, you got to be ready to intervene. But what we found during the focus group when we were, you know, talking about all the different delays between 2:00 and 3:17 when you just hear those facts, mom presents at 2 o'clock, C-section at 3:17, it doesn't sound that egregious. And frankly, when we did the focus group, we were a bit frightened. The way the focus group was set up is that we had 21 prospective jurors. At the end of the presentation, they broke off into groups of seven. We did not, quote, win any of the groups. We did not have a unanimous verdict in favor of the plaintiff in front of any of the three groups that we were using as prospective jurors. And what that really did is it caused us to shift our focus, shift our theme of the case from a theme that was, you know, based on time periods between 2 and 2:20 and 2:30 and 2:45, and we just made it about action, okay? Because that's an easier concept, I think, for people to understand. When you present the case, okay, at 2 o'clock, she's at the hospital, she recognized, the husband recognized something wasn't right. They did exactly what they were supposed to do. She gets to the hospital, and at that point, you're relying on the doctors to be in a position to intervene. So when we shifted the focus to the case of the case to make it more about their action, I think that was easier for people to understand. And we truly always felt we were on the right type of the case. It just didn't make sense that at the time, at 2:05 in the morning, given how remote from delivery Jamie was, and the symptoms that she presented with, it just didn't make sense that the doctor would go back to sleep as opposed to getting everybody ready. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to do a C-section right that second, but it wasted precious time, because exactly what you would expect to happen with someone remote from delivery who has a placental abruption, which, by the way, it doesn't fix itself. You could go on to have a natural childbirth, but the placental abruption doesn't get better. It doesn't reattach. It's just a matter of whether or not the labor progresses in a way where you can have a natural birth without compromising the baby and more specifically, the baby's oxygenation status. And exactly what you would expect to happened at approximately 2:30 in the morning, and the fetal heart rate strips get really bad. And so what happened was... There was a combination of an acute profound asphyxia towards the end of the birth between 3 o'clock and 3:17, where most the oxygen supply was mostly cut off, and then a partial prolonged asphyxia, which is, if you imagine a hose, you're not necessarily turning the faucet off completely. There's still some getting through, but there's only so much that the baby can tolerate while it's in the uterine environment without resuscitation. The defense tried to argue that it happened before. Medically, it never made sense to us. I don't really think it was a genuine defense, but they tried to suggest that the acute profound asphyxia happened between 1:30 and 2 o'clock in the morning before the mom even got to the hospital, and that somehow the baby self-resuscitated, which medically just didn't make sense. And I think obviously the jury saw through that argument. But the focus group and the prep was extremely key, because I have to be honest, I had reservations about whether we should proceed based on the feedback that we got from the focus group, and as did the rest of the team. And, you know, I got involved in the case later. I did not participate in any of the discovery depositions or anything like that. I give a lot of credit to Steve Levin, and who took a lot of the depositions. He did not try the case with us, but the doctor and the nurse were very polarized in terms of the testimony that they gave, and we exploited that throughout the trial. I called Nurse Massey in our case in chief and adversely examined her. We did not call Dr. Benson, but he just so happened they called him first once we rested. And then I think the jury just picked up on the fact that they were not on the same page. It could not have been based on their testimony that they gave at their deposition some years ago.
So during the trial, I know from reading about it, Kira and her parents shared their emotional testimony about the impact of Kira's injuries on their family's life. How did their testimony, do you think, resonate with the jury and contribute to the verdict?
I'll start with Jamie and frankly Todd, Kira's dad as well. They're just really good people. They of course we talk to them about, you know, what testimony we want to elicit from them, but they're just speaking the truth about what they've lived with over the last 20 years. And in addition to them, you know, we called, and I give Miranda Susie and Carrie Silverman from my office, Miranda's at Spiros's office, a ton of credit, because we tracked down teachers that had given depositions and had them testify. And these were local people in the community that, you know, they're just talking about what they observed that's documented in their records. And they just gave really compelling testimony about Kiera's efforts, about everything they tried to do. And, you know, that's another thing. I mean, on the one hand, the defense argued about all the progress she's made. You know, she played basketball. She graduated from high school with accommodation. She got a driver's license. And they obviously are doing those things to try to refute the damages that we claim. But, you know, our point throughout the trial, and something that I think was hammered home in my closing argument, was that, you know, they don't get credit for those efforts because that's what they're trying to do. You know, and a simple line that, based on how I was reading the jury and looking at the jury during closing argument, was basically, you know, yes, she's made those efforts. We're not running away that progress. We're not running away from that. But imagine, you know, with the same support system, her mom, her dad, the teachers in this community, her own personality, how hard she tried at everything. Imagine what she could accomplish had she not been limited at the time that she was born, that her lot in life not been predisposed by the conduct of these defendants. And that, at that point in the trial, you know, they had raised, you know, the lawyers on the defense had talked about having kids, and I wouldn't do that normally, but I said, you know, I have a daughter too. And as a parent, you want to look your kids in the eye and you want to tell them things like, dream big, the sky's the limit. And you want there to be some truth behind those words. Not necessarily that, you know, everything always works out perfectly. You know, I'm not naive, but you don't want your child to be limited by something that they had no control over, that you had no control over, and a situation where you entrusted somebody to be in a position to intervene, to act on your behalf. And they just simply weren't. So we turned that whole small town hospital against them by saying, okay, that's great. That's fine. We're not quarreling with how the hospital is run. We're quarreling with you not responding to information that you had, getting the team ready, and doing what you're supposed to do, regardless of whether or not it's the middle of the day or the middle of the night. And, you know, those were just some of the things that I think really resonated with people based on, I think I'm pretty good at reading people, and I felt connected when I was saying those things during the closing argument. Kiera, we objected to her testifying. It was the defense that insisted on it. Obviously, they want to show the jury how normal she looks. But I think, again, the jury saw through that. And one of the most important things that we didn't talk to Kiera about it. We did not prep Kiera. We didn't even attempt to do that. And we did not ask any questions when the defense called her in their case in chief. And I don't remember the exact question, but one of the questions she was asked elicited an answer that included something to where she said the words, "When I grow up." She's almost 20 years old at the time of the trial. And having talked to some of the jurors afterwards, you know, we had set up some Zoom session. When I heard her say that, it resonated really quickly with me. And I'm glad that the jury was paying attention too, because that was sort of based on the records, based on if you interact with Kiera long enough, you could kind of tell that's where she's at cognitively. She's more, you know, fourth, fifth grade, sixth grade level, and she's sort of stuck. And I in my opinion, that them insisting on calling her, you know, it backfired, obviously. So, but I can't say enough good things about the, just the type of people her parents are. I mean, they both kept it together on the stand, but you could just tell, you know, that they're exhausted. You know, that they've, this is, they were looking for sympathy. You know, any parent would do what they did for their child, but this was forced upon them. This was preventable. So, you know, that's how they impacted, I think, the trial. And I think the jury just recognized them as good people, members of the community that just did their best given the circumstances. And they did a remarkable job, frankly.
You had mentioned when you were talking about the case, just about the uniqueness, because the complaint was filed 15 plus years ago.
Yeah.
You have a 3-week trial. And can you encapsulate the challenges and persistence that were required to bring this case to trial, and how it feels ultimately to finally achieve justice for Kiera and her family after such a long journey?
I think there were over 60 depositions that were taken in the case. The majority of those people didn't testify. To condense, on the one hand, to try to condense 20 years of someone's life, and obviously I'm just focusing on like the damage aspect of it, because it's not hard to tell a story that takes place over an hour and 22 minutes or so. Those details, those are just facts. Those are things that are in the record. Those are people's recollections of any conversations that happened. You know, what does the doctor say he was told? What does the nurse say she told the doctor? Now, within that hour and 20 minutes, you've got a, we have to call a maternal fetal medicine doctor. We have to call an obstetrical nurse. We have to call a neurologist. You know, we have to call a life care planner to talk about that kind of stuff. So the challenge of trying to condense everything into 20 years, everything into a 3-week trial that's transpired over 20 years is significant. But the benefit is the sample set of data. Because a lot of times when you're trying a medical malpractice or a birth injury case specifically, I tried one in June of last year of 2022 in Cook County for on behalf of a boy that was injured at birth that's 8 years old at the time of the trial. It's hard to say, you know, exactly what's going to happen in the future. Having Kiera, you know, be 20 years old, we have a pretty good handle on the permanency of the injury. Can she make some progress here and there? Yeah, but it's not going to be that significant. She is an adult woman now. So that was something that I had talked about during closing argument a little bit, is that, you know, and they continued the defense to bring up the fact that she can maybe do this in the future. She can maybe do that. I said, look, we at some point you have to try the case. This is what we know. She has a permanent brain damage. You can see it on an MRI. It's objective. And we've brought to you basically all of the people that have had the most interaction with her in different areas of her life over the last 20 years. And it was a challenge to try to pick, you know, who are the best people to talk about certain things. But, you know, it through a lot of hard work and a lot of preparation, it really, I think we told a very cohesive story. As with any trial, you're not always doing things in the perfect order because there's scheduling conflicts with experts and things like that. But, you know, it came together and we had an extremely attentive jury. I mean, I'd never seen a jury take as many notes. Some of them, I think, told us afterwards that they filled up like three full notebooks during the course of the trial. And that's all you can ask for. I mean, we spent 2 days in jury selection. You know, obviously we picked a group that was attentive. We picked a group that I think was fair at the start. No one was starting out ahead. But that was a, you know, lengthy process. It took a couple of days to get our jury, and we picked a group of people that had no leanings one way or the other at the beginning of the trial. And we were able to tell a story based on objective evidence that they believed.
This case is a great example of the powerful work that trial lawyers do on behalf of people that, like Kira, are, you know, unfortunately put at risk due to, you know, medical malpractice. And I think you said it, at least I thought I saw a quote, that the verdict sends a pretty powerful message about the importance of quality, timely healthcare and ultimately accountability for medical practitioners when they do make mistakes that cause, you know, the type of injuries that Kira suffered. So if our listeners have a case where perhaps they want to co-counsel it with you and your firm or want to get insights about this particular case, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
My direct line or my email, my direct line is 312-516-1129. And my email address is M as in Michael, F as in Frank, B as in boy, at Levin, L-E-V-I-N, Perconti, P-E-R-C-O-N-T-I.com. And we welcome co-counsel relationships because we're set up right now to handle cases in other parts of the state, cases in other states, actually. I hope that the verdict inspires people, because even lawyers that I talk to that, you know, want to talk about cases and the value of cases, they say to me, "You're not in Cook County." Well, think about this, that you mentioned at the beginning, Jason, that it was a little less than 3 hours, the deliberation. So because we were living in a hotel for 3 weeks, you know, we went to wait at a local restaurant, and we went back after the jury had the case for a couple hours, and the judge said that there's a question. And then he said it was more like a request. They asked for a calculator. And as a trial lawyer, I don't know if there was a better question or request that I've ever got. So just, you know, keep this in mind when you're thinking about the jurisdiction, and don't be tied to preconceived notions or beliefs that, you know, you can't get a big verdict in a conservative county or based on a political affiliation. I really hope that this and other results that you see all over the country help you realize that those are myths. If you've got the right type of case with the right type of, with a good client, good people, and, you know, you're just presenting the truth and you're on the right side, you can do great things. So hopefully people take that away from this.
Well, that's a great way to end today's special episode. Thanks, Mike, for joining me to talk about the verdict, and we'll see everyone on the next episode of Trial Law Review.
Thanks again for having me. Appreciate it, Jason. Thanks for what you're doing.